Well, let's start the meeting. We don't have a quorum, so we won't get one. The purpose of this meeting is to get sort of a broad understanding of the human services budget. During the regular session, we usually get overwhelmed with the details. So I've asked the department to make a presentation just to give us a basic understanding of the Department of Human Services budget, which is about a third of the state's budget, so it's a lot of money. So, Ms. Hardwick, would you want to start? And if you could, as usual, state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jane Wilcox Hardwick. I'm Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. And I, in collaboration with a number of other folks in the department, will provide you with an overview of the department's budget. Some of this information is going to seem a little repetitive from what we presented during the legislative session, but hopefully allowing some more time today will give you an opportunity to ask questions. We may not have all of the staff here to answer those questions today, but we will take your questions back and provide a response to you as follow-up so that we can be sure to have any of your questions answered at a later point in time. We are going to use for this presentation a combination of the materials that you have before you, which is the base budget information that was prepared for the 2000 legislative session, a subsequent handout that has been prepared by Mr. George Hoffman for a portion of the presentation, and then, of course, some oral information that we will supplement the materials with. So the materials before you in that packet that you have include a base budget narrative and fiscal page for each program and budget activity of the department. And those are predominantly the white sheets in the packet. I will not spend much time, if any at all, on the white pages in the document because that's really where our focus of presentation had been during the legislative session. Rather, I will be spending more time on a number of the yellow pages that are inserted in there, which provide you some additional budget activity, allotment detail, and grant detail, and we will walk through those at a later point. And then also we'll be focusing on the green materials toward the back of the packet, and those are additional appendix items that we have prepared for our presentation during the last legislative session. So I'm going to start in the green pages toward the back, actually on page A1, with a reminder of the department's biennial budget structure. The second page in the green section. The department's budget is broken down into four different programs that we manage our budget in accordance with. That includes agency management, which is our agency-wide administrative structure, children and economic assistance programs, health care, and continuing care. And so each of the expenditures that we have in our budget fit into one of those program areas. On the side, you can see that it's also broken down by budget activities within those program areas. The first grouping are a set of forecasted grant programs. These are typically the largest programs in our budget and those which often get much of the attention. And as a result, we won't spend a great deal of time on those today except to talk about some expenditure growth in those areas or where we're seeing some growth trends. Each of those are split into the various program areas. For example, we've got MFIP and DWP grants under Children and Economic Assistance, Minnesota Care grants, the basic health care programs under health care, and the long-term care programs and CD entitlement grants under the continuing care program. Those are all entitlement programs at this time. Underneath that, we have a listing of non-forecast grants, which again are split into those various programs. For example, in Children and Economic Assistance, there's basic sliding fee child care, support services grants, etc. Under health care, we have other health care grants. Under continuing care, we have a significant series of grants, including aging and adult services, alternative care program, mental health grants, deaf and hard of hearing, and so on, including state-operated services administration, where we provide direct care services to folks in receiving services under state-operated services. And lastly, the series of budget activities related to administration in the department include those that are more centrally oriented to support the entire agency, including financial operations, legal and regulatory operations, management technology operations, and then a revenue and pass-through budget activity, which is there for technical purposes. And then you can see under each of the other program areas, there is at least one other budget activity related to administration of the programs within that subject area. Occasionally, depending on how the program area is organized, it includes both an administration budget activity and an operations budget activity. And the operations side typically is an area where we fund our major systems programs as well as Minnesota Care operations. And so those are typically split in that manner. The other piece that is not on this page but I think is an important part of the construct of our budget is that it is comprised of both direct appropriations, which you do in the appropriations article of the bill each biennium and often each supplemental budget, as well as statutory appropriations. Those areas where typically a certain form of revenue is dedicated to the agency to be used for a specific purpose. And one of those examples is certain licensing fees are dedicated to the agency to be used for licensing administration. And so that's one example of statutory appropriations. The white pages, again, which I won't spend a lot of time on, but you will see as you look in each of the budget activity areas in the fiscal section of each of those areas, the direct appropriations are identified as well as the statutory appropriations. So you can see the whole budget picture on those white fiscal pages. The next page that I would turn to would be A2. And this information was, again, prepared for the 2007 legislative session, so it does not reflect the appropriation changes that were made during the course of that session. But for the most part, these give you a sense of the ballpark and scope, regardless of having been updated. The first all funds picture for the state, you can see that human services, when you look at all funds, human services is about 38% of the state's budget. In the general fund area, when you isolate it just to the general fund, human services is 28% of the state's budget. And that includes health and human services, not just the human services agency. So we are, as Mr. Chair suggested, a significant portion of the state's budget. On page A3, you can see within the human services budget that we exceed $20 billion per biennium. The base going into the 8 and 9 session was $21.9 billion. The actual adopted budget post-session is $22.3 billion for the department. The largest part of the department's budget, you can see, or 41% of that, relates to basic health care programs, with continuing care, sometimes referred to as long-term care, as the second largest portion at 29.6%. The combination of all of the health care related, what we view as sort of the larger health care related budget activities, including health care, continuing care, state-operated services, and the management associated with all of those programs, makes up about 75% of our all-funds budget. So the bulk of the human services budget is related to the purchase of healthcare service, purchase and provision of healthcare services. I'm going to skip ahead. We'll come back to that FTE chart in the bottom of A3 a little bit later. But moving ahead to page A4, which is actually, excuse me, there in error is repetition. On page A5. You can see that only about 3% of the department's budget is related to administration in the central office. The bulk of the expenditures in the department's budget are related to entitlement programs, MA, GAMC, Minnesota Care, MFIP, etc. And the remainder, and the significantly smaller proportion, 8% for non-entitlement grants, alternative care, basic sliding fee, child care, et cetera, and state-operated services as a small percentage. The revenue and pass-through budget activity, which is 11.7% of our all-funds budget, is there, again, for technical purposes so that we're not double-counting revenue and pass-through. For example, child support collections that are done by the agency that are just passed on through to families are counted in this slice of the pie and not elsewhere in the budget.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Can we ask questions now as we go?
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about this this chart that we were just looking at, the 21.9 billion total all funds. Do you have a chart like that that just shows what the general fund appropriations? Because I'm noticing as we go through that there's a significant difference, and I assume that that's because when we're looking at all funds, we're counting things like all the money that comes from the federal government for Medicaid and stuff like that. But I'm really curious to see how that chart looks when we're looking at just general fund dollars.
I don't have a chart included here for the agency for that purpose, but we'd be happy to get that for you. Anything
further? Go ahead.
The next chart on page... On page A6 starts to focus on the department's administrative costs in our central office. One of the things that folks often raise concerns about is the size of the department's administrative budget, the growth in the administrative budget. And again, as you could see from the earlier chart, our administrative budget is less than 3% of the total all funds budget for our agency. We do continue to look for efficiencies in the methodologies in which we do business, in which we serve clients, trying to be very conscious of that. Human services is in a little bit different position than many other agencies that are, many other state agencies. We operate, as I mentioned before, the bulk of our expenditures are in the healthcare arena. And we operate as a relatively small part of the basic healthcare arena. So we are one of many, many payers in a relatively small part of that marketplace, and our administration at the same time needs to keep pace with that marketplace in order to continue to operate there and ensure that folks get the services that we are providing coverage for. We are also undertaking, as part of the Office of Legislative Auditors Review of Healthcare Administration, an analysis comparing our healthcare administrative costs with those of the private market so that we can get a better sense of where we are in comparison to the private market for that purpose, since that's the marketplace in which we operate.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding you, you're saying that what the state and federal government is paying for health care, you said it was a relatively small part of the payers in the state. I'm wondering if you can give us a number for that, because I always understood that government paying for about half of health care. Is that wrong?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Medicare is a significant payer in the government market, so limited to just the human services expenditures coming from our agency. While we are an important part of the market, we are not a significant part of the marketplace.
Representative Liebling.
Can you give us a number on that, of an approximate number?
Madam Chair, I don't happen to have that today, but we can certainly follow up with that. So, Mr. Chair, excuse me. In the pie chart on the bottom of page A6, you can see the all funds FTEs for the agencies. The bulk of our administrative budget, or 5. The bulk of our administrative budget is in the state operated services area, or about 67%. And then the remainder of our all-funds administrative budget is about 33.1%. So the bulk of our FTEs are in state-operated services in the agency. You can see if you go on to the chart on pages A7, 8, and 9, where we're showing a longer-term trend in our expenditures and our FTEs, that there is some growth in the human services budget. Since the most significant growth we're seeing when we look at the all-funds budget here is in state-operated services. We've had a significant growth in the number of people that we're serving in that part of our agency and have correspondingly needed to request additional FTEs to support those activities. The next largest area of our of management within the agency and central office is healthcare operations. And that includes Minnesota Care Operations, again, where we have had to request additional FTEs to support that activity, as well as healthcare operations, where all of our healthcare claims are processed.
Mr. Chair.
Over here. Representative Abler.
I'm hiding. Good morning. The question, just to, I don't know if it's a statement or you can help me out with this. I remember when the past commissioner was here, he was suffering with some of the cuts that it seemed like there was a ghost town at the central office. And as I look at that, I do see some reduction in the general fund positions, but there's hardly a blip down in that time and then a considerable increase up. Is this, have the duties changed, like from 08 to 06 to 07, where there's a considerable jump in staff? Are we just supplanting one payment source to another and really doing the same work, or have there been duty changes here? It seems like it was a painful time, but some sensible restructuring went on. I don't see any restructuring at all. Can you help me with that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the restructuring would not be apparent from this particular material, but you will see, if you look at the total number of FTEs in the agency, that we were at actually a 10-year low in the early part of this decade. And as you suggested, in the general fund, we did reduce the number of FTEs and the growth in FTEs in 04 and 05. Subsequent to that, though, we began experiencing the pressure in the state-operated services program to significantly increase staffing related to the increased number of folks that were committed to services under the department's purview. And so that was a significant pressure point. Other significant pressure points since that time have included increases in Minnesota Care Operations associated with both policy eligibility changes, including increased scrutiny around verification and other aspects of eligibility that require additional staff time. In the licensing area, we have seen an significant increase in the number of staff related to background studies, a request that we made to the legislature to support licensing staff so we could be sure that we were complying with the statutory timelines for completing licensing activities. In addition, in the administrative appeals area, we have requested and received additional FTEs in that area to support increased activity related to both increased complexity in program requirements as well as increased number of enrollees in programs.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And for the sex offenders, I guess, would be a chunk of that population that we increased the staff on. I know there was discussions, not from you, but other staff, when it comes that you have vacancies in the department, especially in the compliance department. How's that going? Are you finding people to work for you? They said they couldn't get people. That was as recently as last session. Is that, so basically these are positions that are slated. Maybe like two questions. How many are vacant, and how many do you hope you actually fill that are vacant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I don't have our actual vacancy rate with us at present. Historically, it has been in the 3-5% range, although in Minnesota Care Operations in particular, we have had a very, very high rate of vacancies in that area and have undertaken some steps to try to improve that, in particular with a recent project to retain staff by hiring and outstationing some portion of our Minnesota Care Operations to Brainerd. And so we're hoping that that assists us in that process.
Thank you.
A couple of...
You went through kind of a litany of forces that were impacting you in terms of the complexity of licensing, you know, increased numbers of commitments, a lot of pressures related to, you know, demand growth within the Minnesota Care application processing. And I think those are all legitimate issues to respond to. One of my questions is going to be that as we go through this, will you highlight for me where you share with us and respond to those same pressures at the county level for how doing the bulk of, for all the other programs other than Minnesota Care, the eligibility, who are doing the licensing for the majority of licensed occupations, not all, some are done by DHS. I mean, it's just sort of a partnership, and we have sort of a unique the state through some, the county through some, and yet it doesn't, part of my challenge is to figure out where does the voice for the response to those increased demands at the local level show up in our budget. Whether or not you're able to respond to it, just to make sure that that pressure at the local level is somehow communicated.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the particular areas where the administration made a concentrated effort to address that was with the new federal requirements around Adam Walsh and the background studies. You might recall last session we sought and did receive appropriations related to, it was either 11 or 13 FTEs to support that activity at a centralized level. That activity had actually historically been conducted at county level. Our assessment was that it would be both more efficient at the state level, would allow us to use more technology to support that activity, and would also better support children who could enter into more secure placements earlier on if we could do those background studies more quickly. And so our recommendation was to centrally fund that. There are certainly other occasions where both the administration and the legislature has made a decision not to increase county funding requisite with changes to county administrative requirements that are adopted.
Right. My question was just, to me, a budget document at the state level should be sort of a snapshot that really informs us with the best insight of all the hundreds of wonderful people who work in our state agency and really know what's going on statewide, to share with us sort of what's going on in the status of our health and human services system, and what are the trends, what are the pressures, whether you're able within your budget guidelines to respond to them or not. And that's what I just wanted to see if I had missed during, you know, the focus as you're going through the budget, if there are other places in the document. I'm not saying it's here, but as you go through this, if you can kind of highlight where we can find that out, whether it's, you know, services that are traditionally delivered by nonprofits out in the community, whether it's, you know, through counties, just how do we get a sense of, okay, how is our human service system doing? And then in addition to sort of what is the specific request to the agency? And that, because those pressures are there, and I think you need to let us know. We might know from our locals what's going on in our own community, but we don't have that statewide perspective.
Mr. Chair, Representative, with regard to knowing how we're doing, how we're performing in our human services system at large, we do in the agency have a very broad array of different performance measures for which data is collected and shared in varying venues depending on the topic area. In follow-up to the recent OLA report on the human services system, we have made a commitment to work with counties on providing an annual consolidated performance report that will help, I think, give us a better sense of that picture where we can see where some outcomes may not be occurring to the degree that we as leaders in the human services system would like to see. With respect to seeing where some of those fiscal pressures exist on local government, that has not traditionally been part of the state's budget document that we prepare. We are, however, working with both AMC and MAC to try to support them in a process of being able to identify and do some sort of more human services related local impact notes related to proposals that are being vetted through the legislative process, in hopes to support the provision of that sort of information, because I do agree, Representative, that is a gap in the information that's being provided for decision making around legislative proposals.
Representative Flawick.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Hardwick, when we're looking at hiring trends, I think one thing that's important is when we look at the top as well as the bottom. For assistant commissioners, how many assistant commissioners are there in the Department of Human Services? Are you hiring more or less of them? What are their salary levels, sort of the range?
Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, we currently have 5 assistant commissioners in the department, a commissioner and a deputy commissioner. I believe that is the same level at present of appointed leadership in the agency that we had at the beginning of the administration. There has been ebbs and flows in that over the course of time, but I believe we're back to that same level at present. And I do not happen to know off the top of my head what their current salary levels are. The other
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You kind of got to this after I raised my hand, but kind of going off of Representative Loeffler's point. You know, in these documents that you've given us, as I asked you before, in one of these you have only given us the total funds and not the general funds, and a decision has been made here to include the federal funds and present it to us as though this was all one big pot of money. And I think that what Representative Loeffler is getting to, and what I would really like to request, and I think this is such a serious thing that maybe, you know, I think this is a really a serious issue for us to be able to look at the system as a whole financially, as you were getting to. We really need to be able to see, you know, not just when you say all funds, you know, all funds really isn't federal and state, it's also county. I think that's the point that she's getting to, and we need to be able to see that maybe with a nice bar chart like you've got here with it broken out, which, you know, which are county funds, which are state funds, which are federal funds, and I think we should have that every time. I mean, this is something that I don't know how we've gone so far without having it, frankly, because we just don't really have a good sense, not only on the performance end, which you were talking about, that's certainly very important, but we have no idea how much money goes into these various areas, really, without that kind of data.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, we will certainly follow up on that picture for you.
Thank you. These all funds, however, do not include county funds.
That's correct, Mr. Yeah. Chair. This is presented from the standpoint of the state's budget. The other piece that I just wanted to also mention as we look at the number of FTEs in the agency is that there was a change in fiscal year 2004 where 70 FTEs moved from the Department of Education to the Department of Human Services to support the transfer of the child care programs. And so that was also a significant change to our FTE counts at that time. We also, I should mention, have occasions where we have opportunities to receive federal grant funding that is, for example, a recent ticket to work demonstration for maintaining independence through employment for folks who are near disabled, where we then also hire FTEs to support those projects. In most cases, those are projects where we are not committing to maintaining an FTE level once that funding goes away, but those do occasionally create bumps in our FTE counts as well. So essentially the themes here around the changes in our FTE are growth in the number of people we're serving, particularly in MSOP and the sex offender program, appeals, adoption assistance, again, for example, you'll see increasing program requirements with increasing complexity, and then just plain implementation of changes, whether more complex or not, require staffing to support those. What I will not take the time to go through the remaining documents in the green section, but they are there for your reference, including the healthcare eligibility chart and waiver summary. I know there had been some interest on the part of some members to have a detailed waiver presentation today, and there's a conflicting committee hearing, and most of our waiver experts are at that hearing, so we'd be happy to do a follow-up presentation related to home and community-based waivers. But rather, what I would like to do next is ask George Hoffman, our Director of Reports and Forecasts, to share with you some information on some of the program areas where we've seen increases in growth that are a little bit proportionately higher than some of the other entitlement programs, and so that would be our focus on that entitlement program.
Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one other request, if we could, on these yellow sheets, would it be possible to get information going back to the previous biennium? So you have the appropriations from the general fund for 08 and 09. Could we get a comparative breakdown of what those were kind of
In the preceding
biennium
period? Mr. Chair, Representative Thiessen, we could do that for the administrative components. The piece that we do reallocate resources among various allocations over points in time, and so that information we'd be happy to provide. It may be difficult to discern any sort of trend at the allotment level, but we're happy to provide that information.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
One snapshot, you give us a lot of wonderful data, and sometimes it can kind of drown in it. And to me, these have been useful snapshots, but there's one more that I'd really like, and that's sort of really kind of the global picture, which would be a line that would be state administration, which is just technical assistance, writing the rules, you know, running the organization, state-implemented services, which could be the Minnesota Care processing of applications, the licensing that's done by DHS, you know, the things where you actually do the work as opposed to oversee the work, state-operated community services, which, you know, are the old state hospital services that have now moved into more of a community approach, and then the funding of county-delivered services, the funding of nonprofit developed delivered services, the medical care budget, and the long-term care budget, and have that go back quite a few years so we can actually kind of see on sort of those major groupings, which don't exactly follow the organizational chart of your agency, but kind of give us a sense of, so we can see sort of how is the balance between long-term care and medical care, for example, changing or not over time. Is, you know, are we using more nonprofits to deliver services through grant programs or not? Just sort of that big kind of category across your division.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we'd be happy to talk with you about what information you might find useful. I know preparing some of that in a breakout that's not consistent with our traditional allotments would be difficult to do in terms of historical data, but I think we can certainly provide a snapshot in time and talk with you about what historical pieces are most important to you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you. Ms. Hardwick, I had a question. We're delineating the budgets and the numbers and the FTEs about child care, and the federal numbers I would think were not in here, going on what you're saying. One thing we're finding in the child care trends is there are states where the legislatures control how some of the federal money is divvied up, and we haven't done that in Minnesota so much. But are the federal numbers in here? I would think that they weren't, right, in terms of child care. They are in here?
In the federal category. Mr. Chair, Representative Slawick, they are included in the federal category.
Okay. Thank you.
There you go. Continue. Welcome, Mr. Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. George Hoffman, Department of Human Services. I have a handout for the committee. I'll give you just a brief explanation of what we do. We forecast caseloads and expenditures under the current law in the state for the medical programs and for the cash assistance programs and the child care program. When I say we forecast what's in the current law, for example, in the February forecast, in the February 07 forecast, we include increases in rates only to the extent that they're authorized by the current law. The 07 session of the legislature authorized a set of cost of living increases affecting long-term care. So at the end of session, we added those increases to our forecast. So those cost of living increases for 08 and 09 are in our end of session forecast, but they were not in the February forecast. And similarly, when we forecast the next biennium, 10 and 11, we don't anticipate any new COLA increases. We anticipate that the authorized ones effective in 8 and 9 continue, but we don't forecast any new ones. And that will be an issue for the 09 session of the legislature. I'm here today to address a question asking us to tell you something about some of the fastest growing areas of the budget, some of the fastest growing activities in the budget. And in the handout, I have provided a page on each of four fast-growing activities. Three of those activities are parts of the medical assistance program. We have four budget activities under the medical assistance program. In our budget, basically, medical assistance is where the money is. And so it's not a surprise that some of the fastest growing activities are in the medical assistance program. On the first page of the handout, what is summarized at the top is the biennial budget for the MA families with children, basic care budget activity in thousands of dollars for the last biennium, 06-07, for the current biennium, 08-09, and for the next biennium. And so the numbers, the 06-07 biennium number represents $1.2 billion, and the 08-09, $1.6 billion. And then the biennial increase is calculated. So the 08-09 increase over 06-07 is $345 million. And that's a 27.9% increase. Now, I always remind people that a biennial increase is a two-year increase. We are sometimes shocked by the biennial increases. Sometimes an element in the shock is that we're so accustomed to thinking of annual increases. So the annual increase that lies under a 28% increase is more like a 14% annual increase. I've broken down the increases in this activity and each of the other and the next one into the cost of more enrollment in the program, the cost of paying more for the health care coverage. If you look down toward the bottom of this page, there is an average enrollee line that shows you how many people we are covering on average under this budget activity, which last biennium averaged about 350,000 people. In the current biennium, we're anticipating about 368,000 people. The percentage change in enrollment in this activity for the current biennium over the last one is about 4.9%. And for the next biennium over the current one, what we're anticipating is about 8%. Most of this increase comes from our forecast that a lot of the children and the parents in the Minnesota Care program are going to move over to the medical assistance program. If we were not anticipating that shift out of Minnesota Care into medical assistance, you would see a very modest percentage increase in the enrollment forecast. The increase in the average cost of care comes from the rate increases that we give and from other changes in the cost of medical coverage. Most of the increases represented in this activity come from annual increases in the rates we pay for managed care. And there's another important element, which was we rebased our fee-for-service inpatient hospital rates, and starting in early 07, we have been paying substantially higher inpatient hospital rates. Now, the rebasing of inpatient hospital rates is a requirement of law. The law normally requires rates to be rebased every 2 years. We put off by a change in law the rebasing that would have occurred in 2005. And so we had a double or a 4 year increase in 2007. And it turned out to be substantially higher than we had anticipated. And it ended up about a 26% increase in hospital payments. And so that is also a factor. That is also a factor in the biennial increase from 06-07 to
08-09. Mr. Chair?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If comparing that 23.6% for 08-09 to the 14.2% for 10-11, would that hospital rate increase make up a...
Explain that difference? The rate is a substantial part of the difference.
And so one of the reasons that number looks so high is that we skipped doing that in the 05-06 biennium. And so we're basically, this time, we're forced to make up for 4 years of difference instead of two.
That's correct.
Okay. And how are those rates set, Mr. Chair, if I could ask another question? In terms of that rebate, is that the hospital send you information about what their costs are and you just set the rates based on what those costs are, or is there more, what more work goes into that? If you know, maybe you're not
setting. A rate setting unit in the department looks at the audited Medicare cost reports of the individual facilities and makes adjustments for each facility on that basis. That's about the extent of what I can say about it.
Okay. No, that's helpful to know. Thank you.
Representative Abler.
Thanks. This is actually the fun part to talk about. And I'll try to keep my questions brief, although I could have about 10 pretty easy. Was the rebasing for hospitals greater than we thought it was going to be at the conference committee time when this bill was passed? Is that when you were surprised, or were you surprised after the February forecast?
It was recognized, Mr. Chairman, Representative Abel, the increase was recognized in the February forecast.
Oh, okay. So you weren't surprised, ladies, surprised?
We weren't surprised since the end of session. We were surprised sometime back around December.
And with the hospital payments and the rebase, just a comment that this very large annual increase, which is beyond the private sector's rate, I suppose, because of our rebasing catch-up thing, includes provider rates that the doctors mostly get paid the same as they got paid some time ago, just to remind all the people if they forgot that part. But the hospitals, when they rebase, do you pay one hospital more? Does Alina get paid more than Fairview, more than some other one in another area? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Mr. Hoffman.
Each facility has its own set of rates based on its historical cost experience. And so, yes, one hospital is paid more or less than another based on the individual facility rates.
I'll set up for one more question. So there's really no incentive for a hospital to contain their costs, then. If one hospital found a way to do something, and another rate vary considerably from hospital system to hospital system, is there any pressure on hospital system A, which is a higher cost hospital, to do some things that hospital B has done to reduce their costs and still have quality care in our MA system?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not aware of anything of that nature.
Thank you.
Representative,
thank you. What control do we have over the rates that we negotiate as opposed to, or is it a federal kind of formula that we're applying?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, as far as fee-for-service hospital rates, we're applying the methodology which is in state law. Federal limits, I think, are mostly upper limits. on what we can pay.
All right. Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hoffman, I'm just trying to understand how our policy choices or directions sort of translate through into these budget numbers, and particularly in the managed care area, in that we weren't doing very good as a state on child and teen checkups. So in the managed care unit, they put in the contract some stronger performance provisions to inspire increased effort on child and teen checkups within the managed care system. And if that resulted in more child visits to the doctors because of the outreach, more identification of unmet needs, does that also contribute into this, or does that not automatically, how does the increased utilization that inspired get reflected in these budgets? Because they were, you know, they get a flat capitation. Does ultimately over time, does that capitation go up based on increased utilization of specific services? Because I'm thinking these numbers were also, as that continues to ramp up.
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, we have been talking about fee-for-service hospital rates. Now we're talking about managed care rates, which are a comprehensive prepayment for coverage. Those rates change annually. The rate year is calendar year, and the rates are adjusted partly to reflect health plans' financial experience. And so a part of, let me start with a more general statement. The rates that we pay health plans are federally required to be actuarially sound. And so our assistant commissioner, who's in charge of it, Brian Osberg, says most of his negotiation on these rates is with the rate actuary, because the actuary has to sign off, has to certify that the rates are actuarially sound. And so what the actuary looks at in setting rates is the health plan's experience, the health plan's financial experience, current trends, and expected trends in the costs, in the health plan's costs. And so all of those things go into the making of rates. And so if an increase in utilization costs the health plan money, that would eventually get recognized in the rates if it makes a difference in their cost experience.
Mr. Hoffman, just very generally, what percentage of our patients are in fee-for-service and what percentage in managed care?
In the medical assistance program, of about 500,000 total enrollees, around 300,000 are in managed care at a point in time. Now, the only large medical assistance population which is in fee-for-service arrangements on an ongoing basis is the disabled population. That's about 100,000 enrollees. Most of the other enrollees in the program, children, parents, pregnant women, elderly, most of those go into managed care, but they typically have a period of a few months of fee-for-service coverage at the beginning of a spell of eligibility. So there's always a portion of those populations who are in fee-for-service status, but who will go in a short time into managed care.
Representative
Thiessen. Just to follow up on that a little bit. So if someone is in a managed care program but goes to the hospital as an inpatient hospital treatment, is that paid separately because you negotiated I mean, presumably the managed care folks are going to negotiate prices with certain types of providers, because that's, I mean, that's kind of the idea. But if an MA person gets inpatient, where you're talking about kind of inpatient hospital rates separately, how do those two things fit together? Does that question make sense?
As Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, most of our population at any given point in time is covered under managed care. If they're covered under managed care for that month, and they need inpatient hospital care, it will be paid for by the managed care plan. And that's part of what we are prepaying the managed care plan for under a capitation contract.
And Mr. Jitterfall, and you're paying at, assuming the rate that is negotiated through the rebasing process?
No.
Or the fee-for-service
Mr. Chairman,
rates are separate from managed care folks?
Fee-for-service rates are separate. And that's why I kept saying fee-for-service inpatient hospital rates.
Okay, it's entirely. Do the plans base their negotiations with the hospitals on those fee-for-service rates, or do we not have any information about that?
Mr. Hoffman.
I have been told that to some extent the health plans base their, what they pay the hospitals on our fee-for-service rates. And we included, when we recognized the cost of the rebasing of inpatient hospital rates in our forecast, we recognized on the advice of the rate actuary that there would be an effect on the managed care rate.
Okay, and if I could just follow up with two more, Mr. Chair. So the increase in the managed care rates, which is the other thing that you said kind of caused this 23.6% increase, that's also reflecting the fact that in 05-06 we delayed the rebasing for the hospitals, in a sense. That would...
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, that's correct.
Okay, and then one other thing. You talked about those two things, the increase in managed care rates and the rebasing, as kind of... Do you have a breakdown of this 23.6% in that sense, kind of at a lower level of where those trends...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, I can break it down for you and provide the information to the committee.
That would be helpful.
But it's...
Really those two things?
About two-thirds of it is going to be the managed care rate.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you. I understand the rebasing and how that happens periodically, and there's often a catch-up. This time it was 4 years, but you know, oftentimes it can be sometimes less than that. But I'm not quite sure how that works into the managed care system, where actually we're setting the rates real-time, year-to-year. The hospitals and the HMOs are negotiating in real time, year to year. So it should reflect real time, year to year costs in that negotiation partnership. I mean, it's really been pulled out of the fee for service game. And so I'm not sure, I'm still losing how this large increase in the fee for service should then show up in managed care, and if it does in the managed care rates, is there any requirement that it be actually passed on to the hospitals, or do they only get the portion that whatever remains of their fee for service business?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, there were people in the department who made the very same argument, but we had to consult the rate actuary. And it was the rate actuary's firm opinion that we had to recognize that at least some of the health plans base what they pay hospitals on our fee-for-service rates. And so if we made a big increase to our fee-for-service rates, the actuary felt we had to recognize that the health plans would bear something of the same kind of cost, not fully recognizing a proportional effect on hospital rates, but a partial recognition that the health plans as a group would be paying higher hospital rates because of the rebasing of the fee-for-service rate. And to answer the second part of your question, we don't place requirement, to the best of my knowledge, we don't place requirements on the health plans about how they deal with their hospital contractors.
Representative Abler's next.
Just two short ones, and this is a fascinating discussion. With this hospital negotiations and the rebasing and so on, it's based on cost, and is there a factor for profit you figure in there? Is it cost plus, or is it simply based on their cost? And you want them to work for a neutral, positive revenue?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, I don't know the answer to that question. I do know it's, in effect, a recognition of inflation up to a few years ago. Because of the timing of the Medicare cost report, I think the rebasing we did in 07 brought the hospital base up to 2002. So it's basically recognition of past costs.
And just one other question. And just if you could comment, just to back up a bit on a whole different part of your brain here. The enrollment changes, people shifting from Minnesota Care to MA, can you just give me the thumbnail why that is? I know we did some stuff last time, but I don't think
we anticipate that when our new eligibility system is implemented, that the operation of that new system will shift. We'll shift numerous Minnesota Care enrollees over to medical assistance because it's advantageous for them, partially because it's free. There is a premium always in Minnesota Care, even if it's only a $4 a month premium for some of the children. We're anticipating that the operation of the hierarchy in the new eligibility system will cause more of the enrollment, which is now in Minnesota Care, to move over to the medical assistance program.
Yeah.
And we're assuming that they will move at the same cost. What we would have spent on them in Minnesota Care, we're assuming is going to move over to the medical assistance program.
So, Mr. Hoffman, were we already getting federal match then for these people in the Minnesota Care program?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we will get the same match either way. We get the same 50% match whether they're enrolled in the Minnesota Care program or in the medical assistance program. The only difference is that the 50% of the cost that the state pays will come, to the extent that this movement occurs, it'll come out of the general fund instead of out of the healthcare access fund.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to ask one more.
Urban,
I can't help myself. I didn't bring up health math. I was just asking a question.
Oh, yeah.
But then, so just a simple question. So what's the forecast date you're figuring all this change is going to happen on in your budgeting forecast when this new matching method comes online? Is there a date you have in the book?
We have a shift starting, if I remember correctly, in March of 08. We have it phased in over... We have a heavy transition for a year and then a slower completion of the transition over two more years.
Thank you. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with Representative Abler that this is interesting. Can you help me understand what barriers are in place that make the negotiations between the department and the plans and then the plans and the provider not transparent? you know, I don't understand why it is hard to see those transactions or to look at them retroactively, for instance. Can you help me understand what the barriers are?
I don't think I can answer the question. I'm not sure I understand it either.
Representative Murphy, I'll try again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're talking, we've got, you know, a big packet of numbers, big packet of information from the department. We know that there are a number of negotiations that go on annually, Representative Loeffler just referred to those. So we know, for instance, managed care rates are negotiated by the department with the plans, and then we know that those plans negotiate with providers. And I think that the public has an interest in what they're getting for their tax dollar. And we have a hard time answering those questions concretely because some of the negotiation for the terms in the contracts, I believe, are not made clear. For instance, I'm not certain that I could get a copy of a contract from the past. And I'm not, maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I can get a copy of a contract that's been established, for instance, between DHS and a health plan to understand what that looks like and the constraints under which you're working. But it seems like we're talking a lot around those issues, and maybe one way to do that would be to talk more directly about the terms and conditions, and it seems like they're not transparent, and there maybe is a reason why. The why is the question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I think we don't have the right folks here today to really talk about the details in the rate-setting process, and I think we'd be happy to do any follow-up that you would find useful.
We hear that there is privacy matters related to the various companies. For instance, a similar issue to this one is Doer. We can't find out what the administrative cost is for the health plans that administer our self-insured Doer plan because of proprietary information requirements. So you could sort of, when you go look for this stuff, if you could let us know how that works as well.
Mr. Chair, we will certainly respond with respect to human services programs, and to the degree that we can provide information, we will, and where for some reason it's not appropriate, certainly provide you with information about why that is the case.
And Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hoffman, I appreciate the packet that you have together, mostly on MA. And I'm wondering if you have, I didn't see it here anywhere, but if you could put together similar information on the NSEP program, the activities.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pepin, we can do that. The NSEP program has an added complication that the federal funding arrangement is messier and may cause the numbers to bounce around somewhat. So while in medical assistance, because the federal funding is a quite constant 50% of service costs, you don't see any mention here of federal issues except for the clawback on the next page, which I will get to. But in MFIP, we can do the same thing. We can do a parallel presentation. It may have to deal with some changes in how much federal funding we drew.
Thank you. Any information you could provide would be helpful.
Okay.
Why don't we try to move ahead and finish the first page here. we sort of got off into what this page is related to the basically family.
Are we? I think I've covered most of the issues on this page. The one
that the members should realize that they were talking about $367,000, mainly moms with kids in this program. And the next page, the number of enrollees will go down, but the spending goes up.
If I can go on to the next
yes.
page with. Mr. Chairman, if you look at the bottom of page 2, you'll see average enrollment in the neighborhood of 150 to 160,000. This is about 100,000 MA disabled people, about 55 or so thousand elderly MA enrollees. For the elderly MA enrollees, almost all of whom have Medicare, we act like a Medicare supplement. For the disabled, a bit under half have Medicare. So for those half who have Medicare, we act like a Medicare supplement. For the half who don't, we pay the entire cost of the medical coverage.
So even if a individual was in a nursing home and got sent to the hospital, then the full cost of that would be paid by Medicare.
If an elderly person on Medicare were in a nursing home and went to a hospital, Medicare would pay the hospital bill. A medical assistant might pay a copayment. And that's the sense in which we act like a Medicare supplement. The medical assistance program covers the Medicare copayments and deductibles for the Medicare enrollees, also covers other services that Medicare does not. Now, the costs that are in this activity are the basic health care costs, not the long-term care costs. But they are the basic health care costs of all the elderly and all the disabled enrollees in the medical assistance program. And so a fair number of those are in long-term care. And so part of what we're paying for here is the basic health care of people in long-term care. But again, most of those elderly in long-term care have Medicare, so yeah. We're acting like a Medicare supplement.
But if the individual in a nursing home that's on MA for long-term care, if he gets a visit in the hospital by a physician, that's paid by medical assistance separately from the long-term care?
Let me add the complication that 80% of the elderly in our program are on managed care and have their basic health care coverage under a managed care plan. But yes, the managed care plan, medical assistance through the managed care plan would pay for the doctor visit.
That's separate from long-term care.
Yes. In our budget, we have it in a separate activity, in a separate budget activity. Long-term care, the cost of the long-term care service is in a different budget activity, it's the one which I'm not talking about today. Or hardly at all.
Go ahead, continue.
Our enrollment forecast here is that enrollment is heading upward between 5% and 6% a year. Most of this growth is in the disabled category rather than the elderly category. The cost of coverage is a complicated business because of the implementation of Medicare Part D. Medicare Part D started in January of 2006 to cover most pharmacy costs for those people on our program who are enrolled in Medicare. That saved the medical assistance program a lot of money. The federal government, when it passed the Medicare Part D coverage, added a requirement for state Medicaid programs to pay the federal government back most of that savings. And our paying back most of those savings to the federal government, which is identified here as the clawback. So the cost of the clawback is money that we're having to pay the federal government because we're saving money on the pharmacy coverage of the people on our program covered by the Medicare program. And that's why, if you look at the percentages in the middle of the page, elements of the biennial increase, you'll see that the average cost per enrollee for 08-09 over a 6-07 is only contributing a 2.2% increase. That's because the Medicare pharmacy coverage dropped the cost. And so we saw very little net increase biennium over biennium, but if you go down to the next line, we had to pay it out in the clawback anyway, most of it. And so in effect, you could add together the 2.2 and the 7.8, and you get a 10% increase biennium over biennium. And that's the reason, and that's fairly consistent. That 10%, if you look over to the 10-11 column and add together 8.9 and 3.5, then you're up to about 12% biennial increase. So a 10% biennial increase is about a 5% annual increase. A 12% increase is about a 6% annual increase. And so that's approximately what the change in the cost of care is covering. It's costing the medical assistance program, but it's obscured by the implementation of Part D and then our having to pay the clawback. Under the terms of the clawback, we started out paying back to the federal government 90% of the estimated savings. And the 90% figure phases down to 75% over 10 years. And so we are saving, in theory, we are allowed to keep a little more of the savings each year over a 10-year period, starting with calendar year 06.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, the clawback. How are the estimated savings calculated? Is it retrospectively, after the fact? Is it prospectively? How did the federal government decide that? And
the federal government, Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the federal government put a general requirement in the federal law. CMS implemented regulations and estimated, they required us to give them data on our historical pharmacy costs and on the amount of the rebates that we got, because the rebates are allowed for. And what they end up calculating is a dollar amount per Medicare enrollee fully eligible for our MA program, which we have to pay them. And so they send us a bill each month, and they are currently charging us $122 per month for each Medicare enrollee on the medical assistance program. And that's how they, and then each year they update that charge. And that charge is intended to represent, it isn't 90% anymore. The first year was 90. Let's say in the first year, it represented 90% of the estimated net state share saving for each person each month.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's and that's kind of a real time calculation each year. So if we actually do things that save us money otherwise in the way we negotiate some of these contracts, we don't see the benefit of that necessarily, and the clawback would take into account those. Is that saving?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, well, the original issue was we may have done something to save on pharmacy costs, and it may have been after they established the base. But now it's basically the Medicare program paying the pharmacy costs for the Medicare enrollees, and a methodology established for what they're going to charge us. And the only variable currently of importance to us is what inflation factor they are going to use each year to adjust the what is currently $122 per person per month.
That's helpful. Thanks.
Representative Abler.
Kind of sift through this. Back to some of my hospital questions and just and the plan questions. You're just provoking all kinds of thoughts here. There's three major, four or five major HMOs in the state, and you would pay them this number per month price. Do they all get paid the same, or do you negotiate separate rates with different health plans?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the rates differ by geographically. And so there's a Hennepin rate, there's a metro rate, there's outstate rates. Each of these rates that I'm saying is actually a table of rates by age and gender. Mm-hmm. I believe the rates are pretty much the same across the plans for the same age and gender person in the same program in the same geographical area. I think the differences are minor. Overlaid on top of that is a risk adjustment methodology which looks at the data at the utilization of people in the different health plans and makes a risk adjustment which is different for each of the health plans according to the data on the experience of the different plans.
Just
Representative Abler.
And so but for the same risk adjusted person, it's pretty much the plan gets there's a value and the plan has to live on that.
I'm not expert in the rates, but I think the differences among plans for that same person are small, except the risk adjustment is at the plan level, it's not at the person level.
Mr. I guess I'd be interested to know, just the question, do the plans negotiate separately or is it a unified rate? That'd be, we're trying to find ways to make this work better. That's really the heart of my question on that part of it.
Mr. Chair, it seems that there are lots of questions around the managed care rate setting piece, and I might suggest that we, at a separate time, schedule an opportunity for us to have some folks here who could share more expertise in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And just one last thing for the homework, then. If you could, I know, but you're the financial guy, so that's why I thought you'd know the financial question, Mr. Hoffman. One last question. Do you take a savings for managed care anymore? Or do you just consider it to be the same as the fee-for-service?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Abler, the federal requirement of actuarial soundness is interpreted not to permit us to take a discount just because it's managed care. We did that in the early days of managed care. We are not able to do that anymore.
Thank you.
Representative Bunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, several comments back when you were giving the overview when you got to the enrollees line. You mentioned that the bulk of the increase in enrollees was disabled rather than elderly. is that a disability increase in, based on underlying demographic trends, that the overall shifting in the age profile is leading to a large number of disabled as well, or is there something else driving increase in the number of disabled to enroll in the program?
Mr. Hoffman.
So, Mr. Chairman, Representative, the increase in the disabled is not new. It's been reasonably steady. It's driven by change in the number of people on the federal SSI program, the eligibility review disability determinations at the state level that we call SMRT, which is State Medical Review Team. We have not looked very hard at this because it's been a fairly consistent trend in the enrollment of the disabled. It's just that there is more growth in that area than there is in the elderly, and that's in part because elderly population growth at risk of long-term care is at a historic low currently. It was higher 10 years ago. It's going to start to rise in the future, but at the moment the growth is very modest. And half of the elderly on our program are in nursing homes.
Representative Bond, I just before you, but I've been here 15 years, and 15 years ago, the big increase was people with disabilities, mm-hmm. not seniors. Mm-hmm. So that trend has been around for a while.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, I'm just being relatively new to this. Is wondering, other than changes in federal SSI definitions and eligibility requirements, what in our population, other than population growth generally, but if this number is outstripping on an annual basis overall increase in the population, and it's not being driven by the shifting of the demographic profile, then what is it over time in our societies leading to proportionally largest numbers of people classified as disabled? So I guess that's, and there may be many, many things that go into that and beyond this discussion, but I was trying to get a...
I asked that same
that.
Question 15 years ago and never got a good answer.
Okay.
Yeah, but I will say that part of it is because our medical care is better and people that used to die don't die. Particularly if you look at brain injuries, we're keeping them alive. Was that it, Representative Bunn? Representative Wapler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hoffman. It's interesting to hear that the actuarial federal oversight won't let you take the discount for managed care, but I know in a different role when I wasn't sitting at this table, when the decision was made to transfer EW elderly waiver to managed care, the savings that could be booked in that budget decision were driving the decision. And then I was told later they weren't implemented, and now I understand why. But can you explain to me what the increases are here in the EW shift to managed care of 9.3% in the 08-09 and then 5.5% in 10-11?
Mr. Hoffman.
So Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, the EW shift to managed care shows up here because it moves expenditures from one budget activity into another one. And so this is shown here basically as a shift from another budget activity. And as when people are in elderly waiver managed care, we pay an add-on to their capitation, and it's paid in, we treat the capitation payment as falling into this budget activity. And so that's the reason for the shift. So if we hadn't moved people into managed care, I believe you would see similar additional cost growth in the waiver activity.
Representative Austin.
And just to clarify, they were transferred into this budget item though at basically 100% of their previous cost plus whatever inflation. Is that correct?
Mr. Hoffman.
They are being moved out of fee-for-service arrangements into this budget activity at capitation rates that are set based on expected costs in the managed care arrangement. It's not specifically tied to an individual cost experience before that. And so it's like other movement into managed care. Some people we may be paying more for, some people we may be paying less. The actual experience appears to me like we are paying about the same under managed care as we would have paid under fee-for-service.
Okay, why don't we try to finish up this page here? But we will. We will have a hearing later on the how managed care is negotiated.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I've explained all the mysterious labels, and so maybe we can go on to the next page.
Escape while you can.
So the third activity is MA long-term care waivers and home care. This I have not tried to analyze in the same way because it's made up of a very disparate set of services, and you can't really analyze it at the aggregate level of how many people. And the reason for that is that the DD waiver, the MRRC waiver, I'm accustomed to calling the MRRC waiver, is the largest piece. It has the largest number of people in it. There are about 14,000 people in the MRRC waiver, and the cost of the MRRC waiver on a monthly basis is about $4,700 or $4,800. And so it's by far the most expensive per person of all the services on this page. In contrast, the elderly waiver, which we see falling, and that's because of the shift over to the other budget activity, and the CADI waiver, which is alternative to nursing home care for people under 65, each of those has a monthly cost in the neighborhood of $1,100 a month. So those are much less expensive per person per month than the MRRC waiver. Now the biggest dollar growth is in the MRRC waiver because it has the biggest dollar base. The biggest percentage growth is in the CADI waiver. Looking down at the bottom of the page, the CADI waiver we have going up 68% for this biennium over the last biennium. And a substantial part of the reason for that is that there were caseload caps on the CADI waiver and on the traumatic brain injury waiver, which expired at the end of fiscal 07. And so we are anticipating rapid enrollment growth in both of these waivers, and that, in simple terms, is the reason for the big growth in forecasted expenditures in those waivers. The MRRC waiver, there were some limits in effect also on the MRRC waiver. They were not as drastic as the caseload caps on the other waivers, and so there is some additional caseload growth on the MRRC waiver, which is in the forecast. But it does not cause a very dramatic percentage increase in that waiver.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hoffman, since we have 5,000 people on a waiting list for MRRC waivers and we're allowing replacement, so there is still some growth, would you project out those waiting lists?
Mr. Hoffman.
We forecast the MRRC waiver as being constrained by the budget limits in place on those waivers. So we do not look at how many people are on the waiting list.
You wouldn't project out what the number would be on the waiting list in 10 or 11. You just project out expenditures primarily.
We forecast how many are going to be on the waiver, but we don't construct it based on information about the waiting list.
We're also going to have a hearing on just on the waiver. I think so. We'll get that in more detail later. Go ahead.
If there aren't other questions, if there are other questions on this page,
don't see any, so go ahead.
I can go on to the fourth activity, which will look like very small numbers compared to what we've been talking about in medical assistance. This is the group residential housing program. Its cost growth has been fairly steady. It pays for housing costs for a group which is currently about 15,000 people. Most of them are on the SSI program. They're either elderly or disabled on the SSI program. A minority of them are not on the SSI program. They are placed in a setting by the county, and the counties are the ones who negotiate the rates in these settings. Under limits imposed by state law, you can see the forecasted increase in expenditures is 18.5% for the current biennium over the last biennium. So that's about 9% a year. Most of it is more people on the program. A lesser part of it, a bit less than half, is the average cost per person on the program. There are some limited increases in cost allowed in certain parts of this program under state law. Most of the rest of it comes from the mix of people in the program and from the level of cost of the new people coming in as opposed to the existing people. And so it's compared to any part of the medical assistance program, this is a much simpler business.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is just sort of an editorial comment, but just to let you know, I mean, I think this is really a huge emerging issue for us, and there's been a lot of state money put into housing programs, but they haven't been interrelated with the human services need. And, for example, right now, I think counties collectively are paying, I don't know, probably $4 or $5 million as penalties for people under 65 who are disabled in nursing homes. And the key to getting them out is affordable housing. They don't have budgets that allow for that. There's a shortage of affordable housing, and they don't always compete effectively in the private market. And I've just become aware that we're re-ghettoizing a lot of our disability populations, and that we made a big effort and spent many, many millions of dollars creating, you know, downsizing the state hospitals and really trying to get out of institutional care, whether it's through ICFMRs or state-operated large institutions, and now we're creating them by buying up entire apartment buildings or arranging apartment lease by apartment lease to entirely fill a building with people with disabilities. And I think we really need to look at whether that's a policy goal that we want to encourage, but our financial practices are actually making that happen.
Mr. Representative Abrams.
Thank you. I think I'll combine my question on the last two pages. A lot of talk about evidence, for either one of you, I don't know where it would go if it's next time, but there's a lot of talk about evidence-based and best practices and so on. I know in the waivers it's run by a case manager, and there's some loose connection with the state, these case managers that the counties run them. I think that's quite correct about that. But is there any work that either you know of in these, like either residential housing programs or in the waivers, the long-term waivers, about best practices? And if, as we, there's a certain way to treat those kind of types of individuals who were in the program. There's probably a best way to treat them that works, and then maybe some county has done that for a little better price, and some other county is a high-cost county, and there's really no difference in how that person's life. And is any work on that being done?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, with regard to home and community-based services, there has been an extensive review of home and community-based programs across, I think, most or all of the counties at this stage, where we have tried to build and transfer knowledge around some of the best practices that are occurring in various counties, and I think that's been a fairly successful model. With regard to GRH, I'm not certain about whether that is occurring, and I don't know if anyone else in the department might have further information, but I'm not aware of any.
I'll just give you a heads up, I'm interested in playing with another subcommittee, a little working group at other place by co-chair Senator Lynch. Is that a passive encouragement to do certain things that you found work best, or do they have to do it? And I guess I'm concerned that a suggestion that a county do something that's a good idea may not be met with the same enthusiasm as a requirement. And but there may be some there may be some really good ideas that the department knows and how to best manage this individual and what really works well, even by the advocates. It's even better, it might cost the same or a little less for a better outcome. And so I'm interested in that question for a future discussion.
Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to the third page again, if we could just put back to that, and not on the waiver stuff per se, but on the, we also have the growth in the personal care and consumers, well, the personal care, I guess. What's the waiver is kind of an enrollment-driven thing, it sounds like, more because caps came off. But what about that 23% growth in the personal care? What's driving that increase?
Mr. Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, it's basically the number of people using the service is growing reasonably steadily. A little bit of it is the COLAs for 08 and 09 that we 2% each year.
And if I can just follow up, is that increase in enrollment or use, I guess maybe is a better word for that, has that been a consistent trend, or is there a kind of a increasing trend, if that makes, is it a straight line or is it a...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, it's been fairly consistent, and it's been following our forecast fairly closely. So,
and if I can follow one more question, is that I'm guessing part of that forecast is demographic changes, and is part of it also have to do with reducing number of people going to nursing home or institutional settings? I mean, do we see a comparison there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thiessen, our forecast in this case is basically a time series forecast. So it's based just on the history of the trend and the number of people using the program. We've modified that with some after the model assumptions about how the expansions that we're forecasting of the CADI waiver and the TBI waiver are going to draw some people off of the personal care program.
Okay.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hoffman, on page 3 or page 4, where are quality assurance dollars in here, or are they in here?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Hoffman.
Representative Liebler, only service dollars are shown on these pages, only program costs.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, okay, I guess that raises a question in my mind of exactly what is a direct service cost. You know, are we just talking about, where would quality assurance activities show up? That would be in an administrative portion of the budget?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling.
Liebling, yes.
That's correct. Sorry. Yeah, I put my glasses on to do that.
Okay.
Administrative fund. Yeah. Sorry. I'm conflating you and Diane Loflin.
You wouldn't be the first person to do that.
Okay. Any further questions? Any further testimony?
Mr. Chair, what I wanted to offer, that the materials that Mr. Hoffman prepared today are a subset of the materials that we will be preparing following the November forecast. One of the things that I have found over time is that when the new forecast comes out, we focus on the change from the previous forecast as opposed to its implications and what it tells us about longer-term trends in our entitlement programs. And so following the November forecast, or perhaps early in legislative session, we would have available for you a more extensive testimony and presentation around all of the trends in all of our entitlement programs. The other piece that I know we had provided, or staff had provided to folks, the yellow sheets in the materials today, and I haven't taken the time to go through those, but we are happy today to answer any further questions on those or at any subsequent time. It's important to us that you have the information that you need to make the decisions before you. So, thank you for the
question. You are right that we spend, we get too involved, I think, in the changes of the forecast and lose sight of what's going on with the main dollars. Representative Abler.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. This has been, I think, an enlightening couple of hours, and I appreciate the staff and their help. I have two other questions that aren't related to today's topic. One is, are the federal rules in that case management, are those, can you just give us a thumbnail update on that? That seems like it's an invisible little $80 million, $90 million thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, the federal government has not yet issued or promulgated regulations to implement the targeted case management provisions from the Deficit Reduction Act. Indications are, however, that they will be forthcoming in the near term.
Thanks. And I mean this for this next question in the best possible way I can ask it. I heard in the Health Care Access Commission meeting one time that when we asked the department to manage scanning, the imaging techniques, that they didn't do it. And I was surprised to hear that, because it was for big reasons, and anyway, so that was an interesting revelation. Is there some way to find out what other stuff you guys haven't done that we've asked you to do that you really tried but just couldn't do it, the way it was impractical? I know, for instance, I'll just give an example. In the compliance in the Minnesota Care, we asked, through a great pain on both sides, cobbled out this agreement of some scrutiny, which wasn't done because you couldn't find the staff. And there were savings taken for it, which magically was okay, I guess, because we couldn't do it. But without us defining, is there somebody we can kind of partner on time to find out what you can't do? You know, you can draw anything, but you can't necessarily do it. But is there some way that you can, but I really need to know what things you haven't done, but also we should know as we're doing things what you can't do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, a couple of points in respect to that. The first is that we do try, although not with great perfection, to inform you during the legislative session if we anticipate difficulty in implementing something. Certainly there are many occasions, or I shouldn't say many, but there are occasions where some of the implementation challenges might not be apparent until we actually sit down to implement something. But lastly, we do try to make an effort to inform, at a minimum, the chairs if we are having challenges implementing something consistent with the legislation that was adopted. I find it unfortunate if we have not done that consistently, but we'll try to assure that we continue to do a good job at that.
I'll leave it there. Thanks.
Any other questions?
No.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I think gave us at least a place to start with the bigger picture. And we'll be having further hearings on this before the press of the session starts next February. So
thank you for this opportunity.
With that, the meeting is adjourned.